Daisy.
And I'm Terry.
And this is the Monday Mindset Podcast,
where we share things of interest to us and hopefully to you.
So let's get started with episode number 207.
And this week, it's Daisy's turn to share something with us. Daisy, what do you have?
Well, Terry, I have a quick episode. And you just know which podcast that's from, don't you?
Maybe Quick Brain?
Absolutely. I actually listened to a few episodes today, not from Quick Brain. A couple of things popped up on the, you know, the notification banners that come across. I thought, oh, that sounds interesting. There was something about making ethical choices from the Big Idea Daily or something. And then you listen to it, no, that's not going to work. So I've had a few hit and, well, not hit, misses today. And so I thought, no, you know what? As I'm running out of time, I'm going to go and have a look at Jim's podcast because I will be able to find something. And
always.
Always. Absolutely. And the first one I saw immediately grabbed my attention. And the title is, and I think it's this week's, The Advantages of a Socially Awkward Brain with Tai Toshiro. Tai Toshiro is a psychologist and interpersonal relationship expert. He has a book called Awkward, The Science of Why We're Socially Awkward and Why That's Awesome. And the reason it grabbed my attention was because I often describe myself as being a bit socially awkward, and I like to joke that Rocket, one of my dogs, and I share this trait. So I thought, well, that sounds interesting. I'll listen to that. So Jim kicks off by asking Tai what inspired him to write about social awkwardness in the first place. And part of that, of course, comes from his own childhood and experiences. But he cited in particular a time when he went to visit a group of friends who all happened to be socially awkward. And they'd all moved to new places. And he watched them trying to make new friends and, you know, was watching these interactions and saw how people were finding excuses to avoid them, end the conversations, things like that. And, you know, this made him feel a bit sad and he felt very empathetic and wondered what was going on and why. And he had the thought that if only socially awkward people could avoid those first 5 minutes of conversation, they would be all right. And that sparked his research into social awkwardness, the power of being unique and the potential advantages of it. So Jim then goes on to ask him, how would he define social awkwardness and are there myths around awkwardness? So he starts off by talking about there are two categories of awkwardness, awkward moments and awkward people. Awkward moments, he says, however socially adept you are, you will undoubtedly have had awkward moments. He defines these as deviations from relatively minor social expectations. So the good old classic of having a bit of spinach in your teeth, or I thought of that sort of paranoia of coming out of the toilet with your skirt tucked into your knickers, you know, the kind of thing that makes you blush with embarrassment and is really, really embarrassing in the moment, but something quite often that you can laugh about later. He says this, it tells us something interesting about the social mind. It's like, he says, an all or nothing fire alarm that goes off when there's just a whisper of smoke. It's too sensitive. And he says, in the same way, we are often overly sensitive in coordinating social interactions with each other. We just want everything to roll along smoothly. And whenever there's a deviation to that, we respond with a powerful emotional response. And then he goes on to talk about awkward people. Awkward people, unsurprisingly, tend to have more awkward moments. He says the brains of awkward people work differently to socially fluent or adept people. 10 to 15% of the population is socially awkward, and they have a harder time deciphering what social skill is required in a situation and what's the social expectation in any given moment. They tend to have a harder time executing the social skill to meet that expectation. and also have some trouble with communication. This could be trouble understanding what somebody intends to communicate to them or getting their point across in a way that is socially palatable. An example of that would be somebody who's a bit too blunt. And then he goes on to talk about excessive interest. And he says awkward people really love what they love, but can get a little bit obsessive about interests. And so as he was talking about all this, I started thinking, you know, it can be, it's one of those terms, isn't it? Oh, I'm a bit socially awkward. You throw it around. And I thought, yes, I am probably guilty of exaggerating there a bit. But there were things as he was talking about it, little sort of ding, ding. Yeah, I feel like I do that a bit. And I should imagine, like with anything else, there's a bit of a scale or a spectrum to it. So then to go on to answer the second part of Jim's question about the potential myths about people who are socially awkward. And he says, one of the big issues is that if people don't meet our social expectations, and of course, social expectations can vary so much, our brains immediately come up with reasons why this might be. But why did they not shake my hand? Why are they not making good eye contact? And then we start to theorize. Oh, it's because they're rude, or they don't care, etc., etc. Now you're starting to make inferences about that person's intent. And he says that the majority of awkward people's intent is good, and they want so badly to do the right thing, to be helpful, and for that social interaction to go well, and probably get incredibly anxious about it. They're just a little clumsy socially. I quite like that. I would probably say I'm a bit of a socially clumsy person at times. But he says that's more about ability, not intent. Maybe they're struggling to process what needs to happen in this social situation and then also having a struggle about executing it. And they go on in particular to talk about eye contact, because that's quite a big one. And I certainly found that interesting because it's something I struggle with. He says socially fluent people reflexively look at the eye region of the other person. So it's just something they automatically do. And he says this is really handy because the eye region is the most information-rich part of the face. So it really is a smart place to be looking at if you want to read somebody accurately. Socially awkward people, though, tend to reflexively, so it's just, you know, it's just automatic, look at the chin or the ear of the other person. But unfortunately, these aren't information-rich areas of the face. So the socially fluent person is automatically keyed in to lots of important social information and cues that are coming from the emotions on the other person's face. I immediately thought of that, you know, when someone smiles at you, you say they're smiling, but it's not in their eyes. You can tell they don't mean it. Mm-hmm. I mean, you think about it. The eyes are the windows to the soul, all of that. The eyes are important. So if you have trouble looking somebody in the eye, you're missing a lot. So he says the socially awkward person, straight away, they've missed a lot of important information. And to double down on that, they've sent awkward non-verbal signals to the other person. He says if you've ever had someone make erratic eye contact with you, it does feel a bit uncomfortable. And unconsciously, you may have a feeling of unease, and then you start to wonder, and then you start to theorize. And this is one of the things that leads to some of the misunderstandings of awkward people. And he goes on to talk about the reason for this difficulty with eye contact. He says the reason why awkward people look at these other areas of the face is because looking into the eye region is too overstimulating for their brains. It's a bit like looking at the sun for too long. Looking at these other areas of the face dampens the emotional intensity of the situation, and they are then more able to stay attuned to what you're saying and stay connected to the interaction. They're actually doing it so that they can understand you better, so they can focus more on what you're saying, rather than being disrespectful, disinterested, a little bit shifty, whatever, you know, you're theorizing. So being more aware can help remove judgment from some interactions. I thought about that, like I say, because it's something that I struggle with. I feel I really struggle having a conversation with someone and maintaining that eye contact all the time. I know it's a social expectation. I know, you know, the inferences that come if you don't do that and you're supposed to do it and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I've learned to do it at least intermittently, but to maintain eye contact throughout a conversation, I would find incredibly hard. And when he was talking about the reason why, and when he said, actually, the people looking at a different part of your face, they do it so that they can maintain that connection, so that they can stay focused, so they can better listen and understand what you're saying. I thought, yeah, that makes so much more sense. Actually, when you're thinking about, when I was thinking about what I'm doing it and why I'm doing it, it's like, oh, I can't bear this eye to eye contact. And so I'm overthinking it. And I'm thinking too much about this. Yes, it feels like looking into the sun. And actually, if I don't have to do it, I can better be listening to what you're saying, even though it looks like maybe I'm not.
That's interesting. I'm going to take a little different slant on it, as I'm, of course, focusing on, I wonder how I do that in conversations. I have a bit of an attention deficit, and I know, for example, when I was working on my dissertation, you know, many people need to be in a quiet room with no distraction to focus. I would go work at the coffee shop, lots of noise, not only all of the commotion in there, but I would then put on headphones too and play music. And actually having lots of other input coming into my brain helped me focus. And so I'm thinking, I wonder if the opposite is true for some of us, that looking around, doing other things during that helps us almost focus because we need this other input. I don't have a better way to say it. But either way, I think what's significant about it is to not interpret someone not looking me in the eye the whole time as meaning somehow they're disinterested, they're super awkward, they're unskilled or whatever, to recognize there may be reasons why they don't do this, but, you know, giving them a chance to engage still in the conversation. And then for you, the receiver, to not become feeling awkward because that person isn't maintaining eye contact. I don't know if you've ever watched the show, but Love on the Spectrum.
No, not heard of that.
There was one young man on there, and it was just the sweetest thing. At some point, he said, "You probably notice that I can't look you in the eye." And they were having a great connection. But he was, I mean, not only was he not looking her in the eye, but I mean, his head was turned. But they were having a great connection because she wasn't expecting that feedback that he's interested because he's looking me in the eye. So I just think, you know, part of the takeaway of this part of what you're sharing for me is not to overinterpret someone making eye contact or not, or maintaining eye contact or not.
Yeah, and it's funny. It got me thinking to Zoom. And I remember when everyone first started using it and, you know, growing up in the days of, well, old-fashioned telephones, not even mobile phones, but you chatted to people on the phone. That was in general what you did. It was that or, you know, face-to-face conversations. There wasn't this newfangled thing called computers and definitely no Zoom. And so when it first came in and people were having Zoom conversations and FaceTime, it's like, oh God, this is really awkward and I don't really like it. And I've had to get used to it with the podcast. And I was thinking about it because I feel quite comfortable with it now. And I was thinking about it along the lines of this eye contact thing. And there's a funny thing with Zoom, isn't there, where you're looking at the person you're talking to, but because you're not looking, you're looking at the person rather than looking at the camera on your computer. That person, you know they're looking at you, but they're not looking directly at you. So you don't feel that glare of the sun so much. I just thought that was quite interesting. I'd quite like to ask Ty what he thinks about that. Because I find that a lot, I can maintain that eye contact with somebody on Zoom much more than I could if you were sat here in front of me. So I wonder if that, just that slight, they're not looking directly at you.
Well, I think another layer, I don't know if he mentioned, I think eye contact is intimate. And, you know, depending on the conversation content, depending on the nature of the relationship, how much intimacy can you tolerate? Do you want or whatever during that conversation? And so again, there's some naturalness to looking away, you know, taking pauses in eye contact. You know, if you think about not only gazing at the sun, but gazing into someone's eyes, it's an intimate thing. You know, romantic partners do that, or people you're flirting with, you do that. That's a little awkward in a business meeting.
And people talk about, don't they, how it's often easier to have a difficult conversation when you're driving in the car or something.
Yeah.
Because you're not looking
at it.
Yeah. So they went on to talk about introverts and extroverts. And Jim asks, and this was something that I wondered actually right from the get-go. He asked, is there a correlation between being introvert, extrovert and being socially awkward? And Ty laughed and he said, no, not as much as he expected. And he did really expect there to be a strong correlation. He says, there are two types of awkward people. There's the introverted awkward person, the, you know, the person who looks at your shoes or your ear, etc., while they're talking. And then there's the extroverted awkward person who might tend to talk a bit too much. They tend to lecture about something they're obsessively interested in, going back to that obsessive interest. So yeah, they tend to lecture about this thing that they're obsessively interested in that might not be as interesting to the other person they're talking to, who might be, yeah, thinking about trying to make that excuse. They need to go and get a drink, or they've just seen someone across the room that they're meeting. And yeah, that rang a few bells. And I thought, yeah, that's something I do. I would definitely say I am an introvert, but I feel a bit like I swing between the two. Not really swing between the two. No, that's not quite right. But mostly introvert, but because I spend so much time on my own, that then when I do interact with people, it sometimes tends to sort of spew out in a bit of an awkward way, especially in social situations. I can, you know, repeat myself, go into too much detail, and that obsessive interest, that definitely sparked. I thought, yeah, I'm on some kind of scale of something there. They sort of round up by, because if you remember back with his book, Awkward, The Science of Why We're Socially Awkward, but why that's awesome. So they go on to talk about, are there some advantages with being a bit socially awkward? And he shares a couple of ways, and no doubt shares a lot more in his book. He says the social way, he says the way awkward people process social information is different from socially fluent, socially adept people. Socially fluent people use top-down processing. For example, he says when they enter a space where there's a lot going on, like a party or something like that, the socially fluent person will say something like, oh, hey, there's a great vibe in here. They're able to top down read a situation, whereas the awkward person would go into that same space and they'd be looking at the details. They'd be looking at individual people. They'd be looking at what snacks are available. They'd be thinking in detail about the music. So they're looking at the details. They're not looking at the overall picture. And he says, if you watch their brains working, you know, on MRI type scans, you can see that their brain is furiously working really hard to make sense of what's going on. It's trying to assemble all this information and figure out what that vibe is, the expectation of that situation and what they should be doing. Is this an impediment or is it an advantage? And he says he came across a lot of examples when he was researching the book where the wives were socially fluent and the husbands socially awkward. And he says a lot of these couples reported the same thing, that when there was a social problem that they had, the wives that is, that they're really stuck on, they'll often go and ask their husband for some advice. And the husband will have a totally different perspective on the situation. They'll see details and pieces that are missed by that top-down person. And he says they tend to be very good at understanding the uniqueness in others. And the awkward person will often zoom in on and appreciate all those little quirks that everyone tends to have. And then he talks about social awkwardness and giftedness and how there's a strong correlation between the two. That phrase, too smart for their own good. But people who are really good at what they do often tend to be a little bit socially awkward. And he talks about his favorite study, a study of 8-year-olds who all exhibited a striking talent which had been identified by their teachers, parents, whoever, and how there was a strong correlation with awkwardness, and they wanted to investigate that. Why does the awkward kid tend towards this extraordinary talent? And he says there's some explanation with IQ, but he says the better explanation was that they were more persistent. And you've talked about this deliberate practice that it takes 10,000 hours to get really good at something. And he says those awkward kids hit that target sooner. Why? Comes back to that obsessive interest. They zero in on something with an extreme focus. You know, it's their passion. They love it. They want to do it all the time. And so much so, he says, that parents often need to start setting some limits to rein them in. Because if they didn't, they would just be doing it all the time, 100% of the time. So lastly, as Jim always comes back to some tips at the end, he says, well, can social fluency be learned? Yes, Ty says. Yeah, we all have this need to fit in. And are there some tips maybe to be more at ease? And he didn't really talk about tips, actually, any sort of practical tips, but I'm sure he does more in his book. But what he did say is, what makes for a gratifying social life and the relationships we have, the ones that really matter anyway? And he says the same three things come up over and over again. That's being fair, kind, and loyal. He says this, well, this just sounds like common sense, but it does often get forgotten amongst all the things we think might be important and get swept up with in, you know, social interactions, social expectations, the anxiety around that maybe. But if you think about people who are really important to you, he said he's willing to bet that these three qualities will come up. And he says socially awkward people are more than capable of having these qualities. And that's where it ends. So, yeah, I thought that was really interesting. Gave me a little bit of insight into myself. And that I definitely do exaggerate when I say I'm socially awkward. I don't think I'm socially awkward, but I think I'm probably socially clumsy at times. So personally, I found it interesting. And I suppose because I have that clumsiness sometimes, I probably am naturally a bit more understanding and empathetic to people when I see them doing things that I do, just like you naturally do that. I mean, that's empathy, isn't it? That it's easier to do that if you've experienced it yourself. But, you know, he encouraged people at the end to share it, not only with people who struggle with it themselves, because it might help them, but also for other people who interact with these socially awkward people to help them understand a little bit more. And as you were saying before, to be wary of interpreting those actions in probably the wrong way.
Things like this always fascinate me. And I may have mentioned this in a previous episode that I did, but anytime anyone researches something, I'm always curious, how did they rule out this influence or this factor? Because I was thinking about a recent social environment that I was in where I don't know that, is it because I'm socially awkward or is it because I had always interpreted it because I'm so introverted? And I think what you had said is he didn't find a significant difference between introversion and extroversion. But when I think about some of the behaviors that you described, I've always assumed I do those behaviors because of my introversion. Mm. But maybe it's because of my social awkwardness. It was a fundraiser. It was in a very, very nice home. It was with people there to donate money. So it was already me feeling a little out of place. Like I'm rubbing elbows with people who probably have, you know, different social status than I do. It was for a theater group, not my favorite thing. And so I thought, oh my gosh, how will I answer any of the questions? I'm new to this area. These people, everyone knows everyone. And then I was scanning the room looking for, like you said, is there anything here that works with how I eat? What will I drink? What will I eat? Where will I sit? Because eventually there was going to be entertainment and everyone, well, some people were going to sit down and some people are going to stand. So I was thinking, I want to make sure I get a seat. But if I sit on the couch, I'm going to be right in with a bunch of people. I wonder if that chair would work. Oh, that's right near the piano. That's where everyone's going to be looking. Maybe I won't sit there. So I was doing all of this stuff, again, that I thought was about my introversion and wanting to manage an uncomfortable situation. But maybe it is just my social awkwardness. So it's a fascinating thing to kind of look at, you know, the chicken or the egg. Is it this or is it this? Is this causing this or does this cause this? So I love this topic and I'm going to continue to explore one, maybe how not to downgrade or find my own social awkwardness as a negative, that it can be a strength. And also not to interpret other people's social awkwardness as being somehow about me or, you know, just kind of writing them off in some way. So this is a great little short episode that you listened to. Lots packed in there.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. And just as you said, with looking at those details, yeah, it might be awkward in one situation, but what a strength it is in the other. Mm-hmm. How wonderful is it that that socially awkward person actually hones in on little quirks and details in someone's personality, mm-hmm. and notice that, and actually how connected that is, or it shows that connection and that being seen. You imagine when that person realizes that they've spotted those things in them. They've spotted mm-hmm. those little interesting quirks that nobody else has really noticed. Mm-hmm. All these top-down people have never really noticed that. But that socially awkward person has picked up on that and valued them for it and really appreciated it. How valued would that make you feel? How seen would that make you feel? So, mm-hmm. yeah, I like that. What can be seen as an impediment in one situation can be a bit more of a superpower in another situation.
That's right.
I think that applies to so many things.
That's right.
Okay, well, until we meet again next time, I hope you and everyone at home has a very wonderful week.
Take good care, everybody.